Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're going to talk about some women scientists, four of them to zero in on for you. There were four women scientists in Germany in the 20s and 30s who made significant discoveries in the field of physics. And then they were forced to flee Nazi Germany. And their stories, just incredible stories, are included in this fascinating new book written by Olivia Campbell, who is with us today. She's the author of Sisters in Science, How Four Women Physicists Escaped Nazi Germany and Made Scientific History. And as we talk with Olivia, I hope you'll join in. I want to hear from you. Are you maybe a woman with a career in science? What obstacles have you faced, maybe? Are you thankful for the women who overcame persecution and broke barriers decades ago? I hope you'll join in. Number to call is 1-800-642-1234. 800-642-1234, or you could send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Olivia Campbell, thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's great to be here.
I really enjoyed your book. Sobering at times, some high adventure in it at times for me. But in the end, it was hopeful for me in some ways. And I really appreciated your writing and the lives of these women. How did you come to write this book?
I read a piece in Smithsonian Magazine several years back about academics during the Nazi era and how, you know, they were called refugee academics. They were trying to flee the Nazis, you know, begging institutions to give them a job to sweep them, you know, out of harm's way. And I saw attached to that, the professor that wrote that piece was a project at Northeastern University, where they were gathering all sorts of data about women scientists and academics in particular. So I just digging through this archive of information, it was fabulous resource for me. Lists all the women who applied for grants, applied for money to try to escape Nazis, and whether they were successful in getting those grants or not, how that affected their ability to escape, whether they escaped or not. It talked about their languages they spoke. No, so there's this all kinds of information about the women academics in this data file here. And I'm digging through looking for a story. I'm thinking maybe I'll tell a story about one woman who survived and one woman who didn't survive the Holocaust, and maybe put those two against each other. But what I found was even more interesting and intriguing to me, which was I found these three women with H names, right? We had Hedwig, Herta, and Hildegard, the three main women in here. And they all were physicists. They all specialized in spectroscopy within physics. And they, not only that, they all knew each other, worked together, and found each other again once they came to America, worked together in America research. And then I find out that Lise Meitner, of course, the most well-known of these four women, she also knew these women, worked with them, helped them escape. They helped her escape. It was just an incredible story I had to tell.
It is an incredible story. Actually, in the beginning, you start the book in Germany in 1915, and I think another woman, Emmy Noether, who is really the creator of modern algebra, and she had to have faced many obstacles as a woman scientist in Germany, probably would have been anywhere at that point, no matter where she lived. But
she was a genius. She, I wanted to mention her as sort of like, she's a few years before these other four women come along, right? She's a mathematician. She's not a physicist, but she is just a genius. She's incredible, right? Einstein calls her a genius. Like that's the level of genius we're talking about. And yet she faced sexism in trying to get a job as a professor of math. And this, you know, her story really kind of sets the tone for the book, right? This is what we're up against right now. This is what women were facing at this time. So that I really liked her story as a way to kind of open the door.
If, you know, as I think about it, and as you wrote about, the 1910s to into the 1930s was kind of a golden age for sciences, particularly chemistry and physics. And Germany was the leader.
Yes, exactly. If you were a physicist in the 20s and early 30s, you had to speak German because that's the language of physics. Like that was what the findings were coming fast and furious, that Germany was the place to be if you were a physicist. And because of it was known as a hotbed of physics, it would attract more and more physicists, right, of a high level. So you have it just keeps building upon itself as this incredible center of research and findings, these research collectives and groups of people, you know, sparking ideas off each other and, you know, saying, well, if that's true, then let's look at that. This is true. And then building on findings, it was just an incredible time.
Yeah. Hedwig Cohn spent 20 years at, I think, the University of Breslau Physics Institute.
Yes.
And in 1933, she was forced to leave her position. And what was happening in Germany at that time?
So as soon as the Nazis came to power in January 1933, one of their first decrees was anyone who's Jewish or of Jewish descent is immediately fired from civil service. So almost every university in Germany at the time was considered a civil service job. So if you were a professor, a research assistant, like all the university jobs, you were out of a job if you were Jewish. So we have Hedwig and Lise, who are professors at this time, and they're both immediately fired. And for the other women, a lot of what happens for many other women in the country is they had a male supervisor who was Jewish who got fired. And that person was the person who was acting as their guarantor for their position. You know, the sexist administrators around them were saying, you know, we want this. We don't want this person here. We want them out. So they would have one person advocating for them. It's like, as long as I am here, you will have a job. That was the story for a lot of women. And so if any of those supervisors were Jewish, the male supervisor was gone, and suddenly the woman was subject to, oh, we didn't want you here in the first place, you're fired immediately. And it was very soon after that the Nazis really didn't want women in these positions of high-level academia or lawyers, doctors. They didn't want them in these high-level professions. So they really pushed women out of most of these professions later on anyway.
And Hedwig, she studied atomic spectroscopy. And by the way, I will say that all these women were in atomic physics, and I am not. Even though I have a pretty strong science background myself, I was really pleased at the way that you were able to describe the kind of work that they did, so that even I could understand it, to be honest.
I am also not a physicist by any stretch. I am not a scientist. I'm a writer. I'm a science journalist. I felt like it was a really great opportunity for me, as I was learning about what they were doing, to kind of explain it in the way that I learned it to my readers. I don't want this to be too dense. I don't want it to be, you know, turned off by this really dense science in the book. I don't want to talk down to people, but I also don't want it to be unapproachable. You know, I want to to be able to visualize what they were doing and try to understand as best as possible what they were trying to achieve and what they did achieve.
And what did she, in atomic spectroscopy, what was kind of an achievements, or what were some of the achievements for her?
So Hedwig had a patent with one of her students that she supervised. It was two women, which was fantastic. They patented this improvement of light bulbs. They improved the way light bulbs worked, basically. So she was, all her physics research was applicable to lighting technology, basically. So that's really what kept her alive between losing her job and finally escaping Germany, was that her research was useful to private industry. And so she was holed up in a little tiny lab in the back of her old workplace because they, you know, they wanted her to stay, but she worked for private organizations to help them with their lighting technology while she waited to be rescued.
And I think there was a former colleague of Hedwig's in America who tried to help her and other German scientists getting out of Germany. And it was dicey. It was hard.
There were so many letters. Like, all they could do was write letters. It was just letters upon letters, just like begging anyone they could think of, right? There's all these aid organizations that suddenly popped up, right, solely to help the people that are trying to escape the Nazis. And a lot of them were specifically for academics. Some of them were specifically for scientists. So, you know, it's just contacting, just reaching out to anyone you could think of. And then those people constantly reaching out to anyone they could think of to say, hey, do you have a job for this person? Hey, do you have money to help this person escape? And they were facing, well, first of all, there had to be in America or wherever else they went to, the institutions there had to be willing to employ a woman, right? So that was the first hurdle, was that half the colleges in America were interested in hiring women as professors anyway. So, it was a huge hurdle for them to find any sort of positions. They're mostly looking at women's colleges in the U.S. that would accept them. And even then, if they got a job, it didn't necessarily mean they had money. So a college might say, oh, we have a place for you. We can give you a room and board. You can teach some classes. We don't have any money to pay you. So that's where the grant organizations come in and say, okay, we have a few $1,000 to give you for the year to cover your, you know, your make some sort of money, make a living, right? So it was just so many pieces had to be fitting in, and they had, you know, visas to work on, and all these pieces to had to fall into place for success to happen, for you to survive.
And I think that was probably true of all four of the women you wrote about, in one way or another.
They were all like desperate to get out. There was no way that they could have a job, first of all, that they wanted in Germany anymore. And for the two Jewish women, there was no way they could safely remain in Germany, without being sent to a camp and facing internment. So they are just desperately reaching out to former colleagues, anyone that's already, you know, left the country successfully, which is mostly their male colleagues, male, you know, former colleagues that have gone to America, gone to other countries that, you know, hey, I worked with you a few years ago. What can you do to help me? I've got to get out.
Yeah. And she, I think she was the, Hedwig was the last to get out. And she was the oldest and had, I think, the most established, as you write about. And so it was difficult for her to leave until she got an ultimatum.
So Hedwig was the first German woman to get a physics degree, to a PhD. Lise Meitner had gotten her physics PhD in Austria. She was Austrian, and she had come to Germany shortly thereafter, after getting her degree, to continue her studies. So yes, we have Hedwig as the first, and then she's there left last, last woman standing, who's the physics professor, who's a woman. And it's really tight. She's really a few weeks away from being rounded up and deported to a camp. And she finally gets those visas all lined up and the jobs all lined up. And it's only because of the work of all, of her the other people I write about. We have Herta, we have Hildegard and Lise. They're all trying to help her get out and be safe.
And she gets out. I think you said it was in April she learns that if she's not out of the country by June 15th, she's going to a camp.
Yeah, it was, she knew. Like, you could see the tone of her letters sort of change then. She was my favorite character in the book, because she just has this indomitable spirit that, throughout this desperate time, she is just so hopeful. And you see a little bit when she hears that news that it's coming, that her letters are a little bit more like more resigned, but she's still hopeful. She's still hoping. And once she finally makes it to America, she's her spirit is still there. You know, they haven't squashed her spirit. She's just an incredible person.
She was indeed. Olivia Campbell, our guest today, her book, fascinating book, it's titled Sisters in Science. And the subtitle, How Four Women Physicists Escaped Nazi Germany and Made Scientific History. You can join in with your questions or comments. Love to hear from you. The number is 800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking today with Olivia Campbell, author of the book Sisters in Science, How Four Women Physicists Escaped Nazi Germany and Made Scientific History. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today. Questions or comments, I hope you'll join in, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. And there were some kind of historic barriers preventing women academics from enrolling or teaching at American universities, were there not?
There were a lot of universities in America at the time that still sort of had blanket policies that they just didn't hire women as professors. And there were some that sort of had an unspoken policy that they didn't hire women, right? They maybe had someone in charge of various departments who had decided that women were not a good fit, that women weren't going to, you know, be employed there. And so it was sort of an unspoken rule. And the letters from some of these administrators of colleges, I loved including those because they were just the reasons they're giving of like, oh, it's such a mistake to hire a woman. This, why are you doing this? This is, you know, the young men in college will never, you know, trust or respect a woman. It was just wild to hear these men rant about how terrible it would be to allow a woman in just because she was a woman, you know, totally ignoring how qualified and how intelligent and what a great professor they were, how long they'd been already teaching. You know, these were not young women. These were in their 40s and 50s by the time this was happening. And they had very well-established careers in Germany. They weren't like fresh out of college or something. You know, they knew their stuff and they had proven that. And the fact that these administrators would be so worried. And there was also this idea that they might be a spy, right? That they might be information gathering. So there's so many levels of what they had to dig through to find any kind of help in the way of a job.
Well, you think about it, and here is Germany, which is sort of the pinnacle for science, and especially in physics. And yet that wasn't enough, especially for women, as you point out. Now, people like Albert Einstein, James Franck, maybe these guys were able to easily get out. Everybody, you know, because they had names.
Yes, they were already Nobel laureates by this point. They were known. They were household names. They could go wherever they wanted, right? And if you look at I don't begrudge Frank his income, but if you look at his income compared to what the women are being offered, and they're in the same, you know, Lise Meitner and James Franck came up in the same exact time frame. You know, they were assistants at the same time. They got became supervisors around the same time. And if you look at what the women were offered for salaries compared to what he's earning, you know, it's half, it's a quarter. You know, it's really ridiculous. But yes, so many men were just plucked out right away. They could escape no problem. They were seen as a great catch, a great find, while the women were like, oh, you know, we don't want that. There's no way they could be as good as a man. There's no jobs for you here. It was really horrific.
Even at the science meetings, I noticed you wrote about smokers that they would have. So if there were women, of course, women and men were, at that time, it was considered not right for women and men to be smoking together. And so they would have smokers so that the women wouldn't show up.
It was just all these ways that they, yes, these unspoken, well, you can come, but we're, you know, not really. We don't really want you here. We're going to make it as unwelcoming as possible. So, yeah, that was the unspoken language. It was the cue for women, if it said smoker in the invitation, that they really weren't being invited.
You know, one of the things that caught my eye, sort of in a way a side note, you mentioned that physics was considered a subject study for women, not for men. Do you remember the thinking on that?
It was well before, you know, when physics first came along, it was sort of considered a more feminine thing. And that definitely, you know, for all the sciences, as soon as it became something that was like an official science that needed a degree, that, you know, was needed rigorous study, that's when it suddenly became a man's turf, right? So many sciences are that are considered, you know, okay for women, sort of feminine enough, like botany, being a nurse, those kinds of things. But yeah, when physics first appeared, it was, you know, oh, studying the natural world, well, that's women's stuff, you know, women can have that one. But yes, as soon as things become official and they realize what's all going on here, what's at stake, it's big, becomes the men's domain.
Habilitation, a requirement to teach at the university level in Germany required, I think it's called habilitation. Maybe explain what that was and how women were barred from pursuing it.
Yes, this was a huge deal. So Hedwig was the first, among the first, like all these women are around the same age. Lise is a little bit older, but Hedwig and Hertha Hildegard, those are among the first women who were officially allowed to get degrees in Germany. There were different states in Germany that allowed women to enter universities at different times, but the overall, these are the first women who were allowed. So, you know, they've been held back in that regard for a long time. So they finally allowed to get degrees. Okay. Well, what am I going to do with it? Well, I'm going to be a professor, so I'll apply to do a habilitation. Well, habilitation is basically a whole other thesis. So it's a huge paper. It's proof that not only you know your stuff, but that you could teach it as well. You know, this is it's very official. It's a big deal to be a professor in Germany at this time. And that was just another layer of women being kept out was for a long time. While you know, women have just been allowed to attend university. Well, I don't know about you, you know, being allowed to do the habilitation. So it was individual universities had their own rules about whether women were allowed or not. And I think some of the rules specifically said it was only men or used language that included the word men so that they would use that as a way to keep women out. But yes, there was a lot of anti-Semitism at universities at this time, and there was a lot of sexism, and then both of those things will work against women who were applying for habilitation. Didn't matter if they knew their stuff, didn't matter if they were going to be good professors, if they were Jewish, if they were women, no, they would get turned down.
Let's talk about Lise Meitner for, you know, I think it was 16 years before Hitler came to power. Lise Meitner had led a physics department at a German institution. Just talk about her.
Lisa's really incredible. She is definitely a trailblazer in this field. She's so tiny. She's about like 5 feet tall and she's very skinny. She's slight, you know, and I love to picture her like coming in front of a class and, you know, demanding the respect and attention that she deserves. She grew into it. I think she was very shy at first. But she became a really incredible professor. She was very particular. She had her lab, you know, just how she wanted it. But when she first came to Germany to research, they were, you know, the lab owner was like, I don't know if we should let you in. We had a woman in here before whose hair caught on fire. And, you know, she was like, okay, I promise to keep my hair back. And you know, that won't be a big deal. So they only let her into the basement. So they create a workshop research space in the basement, her and Otto Hahn, her partner. So then She's not allowed to enter the institute through the regular doors. She has to go through the special back door to the basement only. There's no bathrooms in the basement. She has to go down the street to the restaurant to use the restroom. You know, this was ridiculous treatment for someone who has a physics PhD from University of Vienna. You know, it was ridiculous. So, but then she, you know, she works her way up and fights through sexism to eventually have her own, you know, section at the KWI, the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute for Physical Chemistry. So she's a physicist in this chemistry lab. And it's just a really, really incredible interdisciplinary research going on. You know, we've got chemists and the physicists, and it's really, really wild, incredible things coming up.
So, and her, I know in some of her research, I think she and Otto had developed a way to eradicate cancerous growths to begin with. From that was one thing that she did. It was amazing.
Yes, they discovered elements. They had practical applications for healthcare for what they were discovering for radiation. That helped to make them money and notoriety. And then, of course, it was her idea to begin the research project that eventually led to her discovering nuclear fission. But that was interrupted, of course, by her being forced to flee for her life. But she tried to continue that research with Otto via letters and at her new lab. And so that was a really fascinating back and forth of that.
That was just amazing. But she had a passport. So she thought, okay, I'll be able to get out. I've got my passport. But then Germany took over her country, and so then she no longer had a passport.
Right. So Germany annexed Austria. So her Austrian passport it meant nothing anymore. She had no passport. So she, you know, she's all set to leave. And suddenly she can't leave anymore. This is a story for many of these women. It's like they get everything lined up and then something happens. Like there's a new directive, there's a new law or something that's like, nope, no, you can't get out this time. Or, you know, I think war was declared for one of them. And so they couldn't escape this direction anymore. And, you know, it was one thing after another. So, yeah, she's like, oh, my gosh, I'm trapped here. You got the head of the Secret Service, like, looking into my case and what is going on.
And she got out, but it was difficult.
It was touch and go. She had like five men who were friends and colleagues, like plotting to how to get her out, right? Like, okay, we'll have this friend of hers like casually bump into her at the train station and like, oh, you're going the same way as I am, you know, like, and she could only pack like her suitcase for a very light, you know, summer vacation pack. Like she was going home to Austria for a visit. It will, you know, she had to leave most of her stuff behind. The Nazi police would look into your luggage. They would decide, you know, for Jewish people, if their luggage was high value, if they had anything they felt was important, they would just take it, or they would tax it heavily. Luckily, she didn't have any of those problems. But yeah, she just had like a few dollars, you know, and this light case, and she makes it over across the border on this train with her friend. It was. She was very worried, very nervous about that border crossing, but she made it.
But she had set up, as we talk about nuclear fission, she had worked for several years with Otto on this, and then really provided him through letters or correspondence the keys, the things that he was missing.
This was her project. So it had been about 4 years of research in the making. She initiated it and asked Otto to join. Otto was like the whole head of the KWI at this point. So he was like, I don't know if I'm going to have time to be part of this research project. I don't know. So she finally convinces him to join this research. And, you know, over several years, she's interpreting the findings with physics and he's interpreting the findings with chemistry. It's a really great matchup. And, you know, they finally get to this result where they can't explain it. Neither of them can explain it within the known laws of physics, right? They don't know what's happening. And I love this image that I borrowed from an article. I just couldn't think of a better image. It's shooting raisins at a cake, right? The shooting, so chipping a nuclear fission. So like, no one had expected that what would happen is it would break it in half, right? They would assume it would like break pieces off of it, not that it would split, right? It was just not thought of as possible. So when she finally figures out what this is, she names it Fission. You know, it's her realization. She's walking on vacation with her nephew, who's also a physicist. And it's just this real light bulb moment. It's fabulous. And she publishes a paper about it. And then Otto publishes his own paper about it. And of course, he's the one that gets the accolades. He gets the Nobel. She is, you know.
Not even mentioned.
No, he's at first he's like worried to connect her to it after she left because of what the Nazis might do to her, right? It's dangerous for her to be connected, to be still working on something with him. So, but even after that, even after it's safe again, he definitely does not give her the due that she is owed. He really downplays her role. And even the third person in their research group is like really upset with him. It's like, she did so much. Why are you being like this? Why are you doing this? And it really put a big fissure in their, you know, their friendship. They were, Otto and Lise were really great friends. And the fact that he kind of pushed her aside for her own research project and, you know, happily took all the accolades was kind of ended that friendship.
Yeah, it was really sad, but it led to the Manhattan Project. I mean, she brought us into the, you know, the atomic nuclear age, essentially. And the Manhattan Project was something she didn't like.
That's right. Her nephew did go to the Manhattan Project. Frank worked on it. There, you know, she had plenty of colleagues and friends working on it, and she was invited. And she said, absolutely not. She said, I have seen the horrors of war close up. She worked on the front as a nurse in World War I. And she said she would never be connected to anything that could create destruction of that level. She adamantly refused and said, you know, do not connect me in any way to this. And yet the newspaper still, you know, created these stories about how she was escaping Nazi Germany with an atomic bomb in her purse, you know, just really ridiculous images of her connection to it. And she really had no connection to the development of the bomb. And she was adamant about that. And she was interviewed several times about it after it happened, after they created the bomb and used it. And she was pretty upset by that.
Yeah, there was even a movie that they were producing, and there was she gained a lot of notoriety, but not necessarily the kind that she wanted. And there was a lot of falsehoods. Like there was a story about her carrying the nuclear bomb in her purse or something out of the country, out of Germany.
It was a lot. She really didn't like it. She hired lawyers in America and said, if anyone ever appears in a movie that even remotely looks anything like they might be based on me, you know, you sue the pants off them. You know, I do not want to be included in stories about the creation of this bomb. Because I didn't have anything to do with it. And I know there was a lot of talk about her not being included in Oppenheimer last year. And personally, I think, I mean, yes, it would have been great if she was mentioned as the discoverer of the whole reason that they were there. But I think she wouldn't have wanted to be, you know, included in this. Or I think it was correct that she would have disliked her being included in that story.
Yeah. Michael sent an email to say the book, while 6 million died, showed how immigration restrictions prevented many Jewish refugees from entering the U.S. How did these Jewish women scientists gain entry to the U.S. when so many other Jews were denied?
That is something I address in the book, the sort of eugenic basis. You know, we're talking about how eugenics are part of the Nazi ethos, right? But there is also this element of eugenics in how visas were being applied for in other countries, right? About how these women were considered more important because they were educated, because they had advanced degrees, because they had useful knowledge. So yes, there is a big element of, you know, acknowledging and recognizing the special treatment that academics were getting and when it came to whisking them out. That is not to say that there were a lot of scientists and academics who were killed in the Holocaust. There were, you know, not all of them made it out. But there were special types of visas for academics at this time. There were quotas, of course, for each different country. So only a certain number of people from Germany could come every year, a certain number of people from Austria, from Romania, all this, you know, had a quota for U.S. immigration. So it was, for a lot of people, they were like 6 years away from getting a visa once they got their name on that visa list, because they'd already accepted as many people from that country as we could in America. But yes, there was special academic and I think it was pastors, religious experts. Mm-hmm. They were in a special group that they could apply for this certain kind of visa that was sort of like a expedited visa for certain educated groups of people. So that's what most of these women were working with, was applying for these this academic visas.
And just kind of not only in the U.S. but elsewhere, you do write about even professors in other fields wind up actually taking any job they could just to get out.
It was, yes, this is a really interesting book that I had included some pieces of information from some sourcing about how, yes, there was like super high level professors working as like camp counselors or like a cleaner, you know, there's anything that would pay you money that would get you out of the country safely. They would accept it. You know, they had to take what they could get at that point if they wanted to get out.
Yeah. Olivia Campbell, our guest today, her book, Sisters in Science, How Four Women Physicists Escaped Nazi Germany and Made Scientific History. You can join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today as we talk with Olivia Campbell about her book, Sisters in Science, How Four Women Physicists Escaped Nazi Germany and Made Scientific History. Questions, you can join in. Number's 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. Let's go to Vern in eastern Eau Claire County. Vern, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, I appreciate you taking a call. Okay, so you're talking about these women in World War II that they say they invented fission. Well, actually, it was Leo Szilard, S-Z-I-L-A-R-D. He patented the fission reaction in 1933, and he's the one that sent the letter, signed the letter, made the letter out, and then Einstein signed it, and he sent it to Roosevelt. That started the Manhattan Project. Leo Szilard.
Do you know anything about Leo Szilard, Olivia?
He is in the book. Yeah, I mentioned that him begging the president not to go forward with the Manhattan Project, not to do this. But yes, it was definitely Otto Hahn and Lise Meitner who discovered the process of nuclear fission, and then Leo came in later. But yes, he was a big proponent against the use of this as a weapon, and entreated the president many times to think before he acted. But there was this big worry that Germany was also developing, you know, atomic warfare, was going to use this finding to create their own bomb. And of course, we know now, and they knew soon after, that Germany was nowhere near close to creating their own bomb. They had decimated their science programs, right? They had sent away all their best and brightest scientists because of their anti-Semitism. So they were nowhere near to creating a bomb of their own.
Yeah. Jonah in Green Bay, we'll go to you. Hi, Jonah.
Hi there.
What's on your mind?
So there's this ancient Mesopotamian woman scientist named, or her name was Tiputi Betekel, sorry, Bela Tekalim, a lot of syllables, Tiputi Bela Tekalim. She was one of the first chemists and certainly the first perfumist. And she's an obscure woman scientist figure that I know does not get enough attention in education. So I'm wondering if the guest knows anything about Tiputi.
That's a new one for me. I haven't heard of her. I've heard of, I've written about a couple of ancient women in science. I have a newsletter every month. I write a different biography of a woman scientist throughout history. It's called Beyond Curie. And yes, there's been a few that I found. The problem with really digging into these really ancient women is, what is there to read about them, right? Like I think if you're writing a book length thing, you could write about several women, right? But to find enough information about only one woman who's been, that age would be tricky. But yes, I love to write my little monthly newsletter, just those short articles about these women who are really overlooked, really underlooked at, and the amount of scientific work that was being done by women in these older times is just fascinating to me. Like before we had universities, before we had, these rules about who could study what and what was what. And when we had trades that were passed down through families, we had women taking over for their fathers in different ways. We had women who were taking over as professors in Italy and, teaching math and chemistry in ancient times. It was really fascinating. So yes, I would love to learn more about her for sure.
And just this whole business of recognition and remembering, as you well point out, I mean, Lise Meitner, I mean, people might know of her. I mean, she was nominated for 18 Nobels in chemistry, I think, as you point out, and 30 in physics, and never won a one. But
right, she is most she's known as being most famous for winning Anno Hahn a Nobel Prize. So it's ridiculous that she never won one. But if you look at the women who did, I think I mentioned this one woman who won a Nobel for physics in California, and the headlines read, "Local mother wins Nobel." The way that we treat women, the way we talk about them when they're doing the same things that men do is pretty ridiculous. But yes, I think Lise was much more famous in her time than she is now. Yeah. But she's of these four women, she was definitely the most well known for sure. She's had her own separate biographies published by several people. But I really like how I was able to sort of find this slice of time, right? I found, you may have heard of these women, but have you heard about this, tiny period of their lives where they all work together to achieve this one thing, or they all work together to help each other do this one thing? And so that's what I love writing about in my books is sort of bringing together people you might know, but the story about them that working together that you might not know.
Sharon in Berlin, Wisconsin, we'll go to you. Hi, Sharon.
Yeah, good morning. This is kind of interesting. I'm an old lady, and when I was younger, I was an assistant hall director to a lady named Eunice Bone, B-O-N-E. And she was hall director. We called her a house mother, She taught physics. She had a master's, I'm sure at least. She taught physics to World War II soldiers or some type of military. Her name was Eunice Bone, B-O-N-E. She was very famous as a hall director because she had a backbone, let me tell you. It's a very appropriate name. But I just thought I'd never heard of such a thing as a woman teaching physics for the Army or for whatever branch it was.
Oh, interesting. Well, Olivia?
So that's really fascinating to hear. I know Hertha, who landed at Duke University, talks a little bit about there's a period when they have like an accelerated program for people going in the military. So they're like, she's talking about how like how busy her schedule suddenly becomes when they're packing in these classes for these people that are going to be shipped out. And also the need for more people that know about physics from a military perspective, right? They need more scientists for the war effort, right? So these universities were ramping up programs to kind of speed these people through. And she talks about that being a real wild time in her tenure. So yeah, that's fascinating.
And Hertha and Hildegard, we haven't even talked about them, are really interesting people and great scientists. I guess we should have had 2 hours for the show. and Hertha worked with James Frank, actually wound up in the end, his wife died and they wound up getting married at some point. But she was almost tireless in her efforts to get the other women out.
She was incredible. She was not Jewish, but James Frank, her boss, was, and she felt very beholden to him that she also leave Germany when he left, and that, you know, her bosses fired her anyway, whether she wanted to stay or not. She escapes to Norway and finds a job there, and you know, the news is publishing like, oh, there's this German scientist has come to Norway, and so that kind of alerts Germany. She becomes an enemy of the state as far as Germany's concerned, and later on her sister is murdered by the Nazis because she's a part of the resistance. But she makes her way to Duke, to America, and to her Frank. Frank is already has been in America for a few years by this point. I'm pretty sure that she was in love with him for a very long time, but she, you know, would never do anything while he was married, of course. But yeah, she comes to Duke. She builds this awesome lab for herself. And as soon as she gets here, she turns around and starts helping these other women that are left behind, that are stuck, that are about to be deported. And she, like, just keeps pestering these neighboring universities, like, you're going to hire this woman, and I'm going to, you know, I'm not going to stop until you tell me that you're going to give this woman a job. And yes, she very likely played a very key role in keeping these women alive, and especially for Hedwig. She got this job at UNC, and for the, you know, the following year, like, she had these other two jobs for further out years, but she had got the job for her at UNC, like, right away. And that was really the key to pulling her out of Germany. So she also paid, like, she like I said, those women were not getting huge salaries, but she donated some of her salary to these relief funds for German scientists that were being popping up at this time. So she was incredible.
Yeah, she was indeed. And Hildegard, another incredible person. I think she wound up in Massachusetts primarily because of the contact that she'd made with Emma Carr, I think.
Right. So she had visited. She worked in Switzerland. She was at the university there, and even though she wasn't in Germany at the time, she was also getting fired because Switzerland was, like, really uneasy about having German immigrants staying there, and they were like, we don't know, we don't like what's going on, we're gonna send everybody back, it's not working out. And so Hildegard was like, I am not going back to Germany, that's not happening. She wouldn't have been able to find any kind of job at her level. She would definitely wouldn't have been a professor or even worked in a research capacity at a university as a woman anymore under the Nazis. So she sort of bypassed, went back to Germany, found this job because Emma Carr had come over from the U.S. for, you know, on a grant to study with her, and they got on really well. And so she was able to reach out to her and say, hey, can you help me escape, help me get out of here and get a real job. And it was okay at first, but, you know, it was a small women's college. She wasn't sure that it was really her cup of tea. It wasn't anything like a German university or a Swiss university, right? It was very small and very limited, and she couldn't specialize in her research like she really wanted to. So she reached out to Frank and Hertha and said, hey, can you help me find something else?
And they helped her out. Well, there's so much more in your book that we haven't covered, but I want to thank you so much, Olivia, for writing the book and for being with us today. I really appreciate it, and I hope the book does well. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been fabulous.
Olivia Campbell, her book, Sisters in Science. It's take a look at this book. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining us today on Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, and today we explore the Mississippi River, the geological, the cultural, the natural history of the river, and what you can see and do along it. And we have a great guide for you, Dean Klinkenberg. He is the author of the new book, The Wild Mississippi, A State-by-State Guide to the River's Natural Wonders. Dean was an academic psychologist before becoming an author of guidebooks and mystery novels, and it's great to have him with us today. So as we talk about the Mississippi, I hope you'll join in. Have you visited many places along the Mississippi River? What's your favorite? Where would you like to go next? Questions about the river or its history? I hope you'll join in at 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Dean Klinkenberg, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us today.
Hey, Larry, thanks so much for having me on. I'm really looking forward to talking about my favorite subject.
Well, I tell you what, you've written a dandy book here. One of the things I really liked about the book was you spend a fair amount of time in the beginning, the first chapters, dealing with the kind of the history and what has made the Mississippi River the kind of the way it is. And I'm sure you were very purposeful about that, because I think it gives us some background before we actually get into visiting along the place.
Yeah, absolutely. I was surprised as I got into this, learning how much we do know, and then also how much we don't know about the river's geologic past. There was a study maybe 3 or 4 years ago that suggested the river's been around for 70 million years, and that just kind of blew my mind.
And it's a lot smaller, I guess, today than it was. It carried eight times as much water at one point.
Yeah, I think this is one of the things that it's hard for us to sometimes understand how dynamic the river can be. And at different points in time, the river has been much bigger. It's been much smaller. Of course, it's changed its channel a few times here and there, depending upon what was going on. Sometimes ice pushed it an entirely new channel. So the river has been through a lot of changes in its 70 million history, as one would hope.
Yeah, as for sure. And as I understand it, the river is expected to grow bigger once again.
Yeah, I mean, there's a combination of a couple different factors at play here, but the short version of this is, you know, when the glaciers cover land, the land sinks, and then as the glaciers retreat, the land rises back up. And the land, especially in Canada, is still rising in response to the glaciers leaving, and that's probably going to change the size of the Mississippi's watershed and force more water into the Mississippi Valley. We're not going to be around to see much of an effect of that, but we are seeing precipitation changes, especially up in your part of the river, where you've had a lot of rain again this spring. Precipitation trends are up, particularly in the upper half of the river, but along much of it, which is making the river bigger again as well.
So we're going to talk a little more about the history. The European impact on Native Americans was obviously great. The displacement of many indigenous peoples. And that reshaped the settlement of the Mississippi.
Yeah, it's hard to get a handle on exactly how many different indigenous tribes or communities lived along the river, but we know indigenous people lived along the Mississippi for probably at least 13,000 years down on the lower part of the river, and probably at least 12,000 on the upper part of the river. Lots of communities, close ties to the river, dependent upon the river for their sustenance. And then as Europeans came in and forced those indigenous communities out, it sort of changed the nature of the relationship we have, that humans have with the Mississippi, and it changed the lives and lifestyles of the indigenous people that used to live here.
Yeah. I was interested in some of the things that happened. Steamboats. The introduction of steamboats on the river before the Civil War and the effect it had on the area. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, if you think about like the difference in transportation time from something as simple as like driving to New York versus flying to New York, you know, before steamboats, you know, people basically, you know, they could travel downriver, but they were at the mercy of the current. And then they either had this laborious prospect of pulling a boat upriver, essentially, from there, or walking back or horseback riding along the river. It could take weeks to travel along the river. And a steamboat, you could do that same trip in a matter of days. So it made the world a lot smaller. And we've seen some changes like that in our world, I think, with how communication has made the world feel smaller as well. But this really transformed and opened up parts of the country to new settlements and that previously were difficult to get to and supply.
Yeah. And then, of course, railroads came along and kind of replaced the steamboats.
Pretty much. They pretty much rendered steamboats and a lot of river transportation irrelevant.
At one point, you write, which I thought was a really interesting way to put it, you write that we have tamed the Mississippi River not as well as a domesticated dog, but more like a wolf cub raised by humans.
Yeah, I think we have this illusion that we've kind of controlled the river, but really that river is pretty sneaky, and a lot of the structures that we've built, they have assumptions about what kind of river we're trying to control. And as you know, as we said earlier, the river is already changing and growing some, and there's some questions about how well these structures might hold up to increasing amounts of water that are almost inevitably coming our way.
Yeah, yeah. How much of the river have you paddled? Have you paddled quite a bit of it?
I've done small segments. I know I have friends who've paddled the whole river. Probably my favorite trip is a few years ago, I got to paddle with a group in a big canoe from New Orleans to the Gulf of Mexico and camp our last night on a barrier island. that was one of my favorite trips of all time. I'm trying to get more miles in canoes and kayaks, but it takes me a little while.
Well, you know, the river's tame in spots. I think it's kind of wild in spots. In your mind, where is the river the wildest?
You know, surprisingly, I think some of the wildest parts of the river are the lower Mississippi. You know, I've had the good luck of going on some canoe trips on the lower Mississippi, besides that one to the Gulf. And my preconception before that first trip was that the area between the levees down there was going to be kind of sterile and uninteresting. And and I got in a canoe and we got going, and I was surprised at how remote it felt, how much life really did thrive in those areas. You know, in some places, the space between the levees is pretty narrow, and in others, it's not. But there are islands full of beavers and muskrats and lots of birds and turtles. And you can go, I think the longest stretch is 60 or 70 miles between bridges. And there are very few communities along the river down there. So it feels pretty remote when you're on a boat traveling down that part of the river.
You mentioned the narrowness at one point, at least, but it's wide in some points. What's the widest part of the river?
Yeah, I like to joke that that's a good way to start an argument among river rats, is asking where the widest part of the river is. Yes, I think if you're looking at below the Twin Cities, the pool at Fulton and Clinton, that area is technically the widest right now, where the water stays, it's like 2.5-ish miles, I think, wide at that point. Lake Pepin is the widest natural segment of the river below the Twin Cities. But up north, you know, the Mississippi passes through Lake Winnie, which is, 11 miles wide? So I guess it depends on which lake you want to count, but I like to say it's Lake Winnie.
Oh, man. How much sediment moves down the river?
Well, not as much as they're used to. So, you know, obviously that muddy color we associate with the Mississippi is from sediment. It's not from pollution. A lot of people think that it's, you know, something that's we should avoid and terrible. But it's just dirt. It's just sediment the river carries. The dams on the Missouri River have blocked a lot of the sediment that flowed down the Missouri River. And really, the Missouri historically contributed the bulk of the sediment to the lower Mississippi. The upper Mississippi used to run pretty clear when you read the stories from travelers who were along the river a couple hundred years ago. They lauded how beautiful the clear water was of the upper Mississippi. But modern agriculture has dumped more sediment into the Mississippi than it used to in the upper part of the river. And now the navigation dams trap a lot of that sediment behind those dams.
Yeah. And I'm just, how is the channelization, the building of levees and dams, it's had a big, huge impact on, I think, everything, but including wildlife. And I wondered about wildlife.
Yeah, but the channelization is problematic more, I think, in certain segments than in other. Like right now, we're celebrating the 100th birthday of the Upper Mississippi Refuge. And there, channelization has been a little bit less of an issue. You still have connections between a lot of the river's historic habitats and ecosystems. But you go south of the Quad Cities, and the river's not really connected to many wetlands anymore. So there's a lot of, there's some loss of species and abundance along that part of the river because there's just nothing to support that kind of life. And the channelization is kind of, you know, in my part of the river especially, like the Mississippi is almost acting like a small stream sometimes. Like the river is more subject to dramatic rises and falls than it was historically because of the channelization of the river.
Yeah, it's amazing. Are there any rapids on the Mississippi?
There are, mostly up north. Yeah, there's a series of small rapids through northern Minnesota, like Pekegama Falls around Grand Rapids is one of the better known stretches. There was also a stretch of rapids around the Quad Cities and around Keokuk. Those are now submerged by the navigation dams. And out down here in my area, the Chain of Rocks was an area of rapids as well.
Well, you go through a nice history, and we've really given a thumbnail sketch of it, but maybe talk about the book itself, aside from this history and background and learning about the river, then we get into places that we can go and see.
Yeah, so the model in my head for this book was kind of like a city guide. Like if you bought a guidebook for Paris, it would give you some history of Paris, and it would give you a description of the neighborhoods of the city, and it would give you some highlights of things to see and do. But it wouldn't tell you about every single building in Paris. And I think this book kind of follows that model. So the first half of the book really peels back the layers in the river's world. So there are chapters on main channel and, you know, what kind of life lives in and depends on flowing water. Wetlands, forests, and grasslands are also additional chapters. So the book kind of describes in pretty general terms what those habitats and ecosystems are like and what kind of life they generally support. And then the second half of the book is a state-by-state listing for all 10 states that touch the main channel of the Mississippi, listing public lands where people can go to have experiences that experience different parts of the river's world. I wanted there to be some range in the experiences. So there are places of wetlands, there are places with grasslands, places you can just have a nice view of the river. And all of them are easy to get to.
Yeah. Our guest today, it's great to have him with us to talk about the Mississippi River and what's going on and what we can all see there. Dean Klinkenberg is our author today for this first segment of our show, and his book is titled The Wild Mississippi, A State-by-State Guide to the River's Natural Wonders. Questions, comments, maybe some experiences you've had along the river? I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking with Dean Klinkenberg, who has written The Wild Mississippi, A State-by-State Guide to the River's Natural Wonders. Great to have him with us. And again, you can join in. The number is 800-642-1234, or you can email to talk@WPR.org. Love to hear from you. Cheryl in Clark County has called to say that they've read the book and enjoyed it very much, Dean. She's curious to know how much is known about the indigenous people who built the mounds and why they built the mounds.
Yeah, boy, I would say there's speculation, but it's hard to know for sure some of the why. Mound building has a long history in North America. I think the earliest mounds that we know of were built in southern Louisiana or in Louisiana at a place called Watson Break over 5,000 years ago. and the mound building culture then kind of spread along the Mississippi. There's speculation that some of the mounds were for burials, but many of them were for symbolic reasons. And I'm certainly not an expert in indigenous spiritual views, but my understanding is that a lot of the times they would choose the tops of bluffs near rivers as a way to sort of get closer to the upper world that they believed was part of their cosmological system. So it was a way to connect the world where people lived with the upper world where some of the other spiritual beings lived. But there are, I'm sure there are lots of other things about the mound building we'll never fully understand.
Yeah. Cahokia in Illinois, I think it's east of St. Louis, that Cahokia Mounds historic site, very significant site.
Yeah, and I don't know if you've ever been there yourself, you've had a chance to travel down here. It's one of those sites, I think, to myself, if they had built with stone instead of dirt, it would be as famous as Machu Picchu or the pyramids of Egypt. It was a remarkable city that was built over 1,000 years ago, and most of it seemed to have been built practically overnight in one big burst of construction. What archaeologist Timothy, I'm going to butcher his name, Pocketuck, calls the Cahokia Big Bang. So this happened very rapidly, and the city had tens of thousands of people living in the main city and in surrounding villages during its peak. Very complex cultural systems. So I think it's, at the time it was bigger than London. It was a remarkable place, and it's remarkable to me how much we do know about it. But there's still a lot of questions about what happened to it ultimately and what day-to-day life was like.
Yeah, absolutely. Barbara in Cross Plains has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Barbara.
I'm so excited you're on today because a week ago we discovered the city park in Lansing when we went over the bridge that's just recently been reopened, crossing from Wisconsin over to Lansing. And there is a city park there with two overlooks, one higher than the other. And you look down on the Mississippi going in both directions. And I always thought Wyalusing's outlook from the confluence of the Mississippi and Wisconsin was the best. Well, this might almost beat it. And I can't believe that'll happen, not in Wisconsin. But it's Mount Hosner Park. And outside of town is a wonderful interpretive center with all kinds of really basic, easy to understand information about the Mississippi, the traffic, the barges. I'm very excited about this new find.
Barbara, thanks a lot for calling. Comment, Dean.
She's right. That's a spectacular view from there. I've made it one of my missions to try to get on top of every bluff that's publicly accessible as I can to try to see where the best views are. And Mount Hosmer and Lansing certainly is among the best. I'd be hard pressed to choose which one is actually best, but Great River Bluff State Park has magnificent views. Buena Vista Park in Alma, Wisconsin, also spectacular views from up there. So I think people should just make it a mission to collect all those bluff top overlooks, and then we can all discuss which ones they like best.
Lansing, Iowa. Well, what about, in fact, in your book, you mentioned Pikes Peak State Park near McGregor, Iowa. Talk about that.
One of the things I like about that, it's a very popular spot to stop for the overlook, and I think for good reason, because part of the reason that it's so spectacular there is you're looking directly at the confluence of the Wisconsin and Mississippi rivers. So this nice complex of islands and back channels that you can see from up there. The park itself is really beautiful too, and there's some nice hiking trails that most people never explore, but the overlook really is beautiful. I've been there all times of year, and I find it spectacular even in the middle of winter.
Yeah, and as long as we're talking about Iowa, and I kind of wanted to zero in on the places we can drive in a day and in sort of the Midwest states that are along the river. And another thing you mentioned is the National Mississippi River Museum and Aquarium. That's located in Dubuque, Iowa.
Yeah, boy, it's just one of the best museums about the river that I think you'll ever find. They have aquariums with fish, native fish and wildlife, so you can see what a blue catfish looks like. They're gigantic. There are tanks with turtles and other amphibians and reptiles. And then they have aquariums also that showcase the life at the the end of the river support. So more of these coastal habitats. So there's tanks with fish that thrive in those coastal habitats. Plus, there are lots of exhibits on our history with the river, indigenous history, navigation. It's really a spectacular place. There's a reason there's a Smithsonian affiliate. It's because they just do everything so well.
Let's go back up. Let's go further north from Iowa to neighboring Minnesota and some of the places along the path of the Mississippi River that might be worth visiting. Of course, the headwaters are at Itasca State Park, are they not?
They are. So that's Itasca State Park is absolutely one of my favorite spots to go. It's a little bit of a drive for me from St. Louis. It wouldn't be quite so bad from Wisconsin. But it's another one of these places where I think you can, in some places, you can kind of step back in time. There are patches of old growth pine forest intact in Itasca State Forest or Itasca State Park. I really like hiking through those areas to get a sense of what those old forests might have felt like to walk through. But the park has, you know, a fantastic lodge to stay at and cabins, a big campground, and then you can paddle on Lake Itasca itself. And maybe if you're lucky, you'll be there on a day when some long-distance paddler is putting in a kayak on their way down to the Gulf of Mexico.
That'd be pretty cool. And you can walk from bank to bank there at some point.
You can, and you're probably not going to get your knees wet unless you're a child. So.
And the elevation, that interested me. It's, I think you point out, it's 1,475 feet above sea level. And then, of course, it takes a pretty good drop as it goes down.
Yeah, the river drops more than half of its elevation toward the Gulf of Mexico just within Minnesota. it flattens out quite a bit after that.
Oh, man, that's amazing to me. Well, the Mississippi National River and Recreation Area, it runs, I think it's 72 miles, and runs through the Twin Cities. How well protected is that section of the river?
I think it's a bit of a mixed bag. I think a lot of it is fairly well protected. There's a lot of public land right next to the river that both Minneapolis and St. Paul made an effort to protect long ago. In the suburbs, some of the land, there's a lot more private land that's a little harder for the National Refuge or Recreation Area to manage. But it's still like there are really fantastic places you can get near the river or on the river in that 72-mile stretch. And I think people in the Twin Cities are pretty well aware of how special that is and do spend a fair amount of time out on there. Living in St. Louis, where our riverfront is highly industrial and dominated by the navigation industry, every time I go up to the Twin Cities, I'm envious of how easy they have access to the river and how easy it is to get on there.
Yeah, and I think you particularly cite Minneapolis as just a beautiful place to, because you can go right down to the water's edge.
Yeah, and the river changes a lot just within the borders of Minneapolis. So the only gorge in the whole path of the Mississippi goes through Minneapolis. So there's really big changes you can see. And when the river enters the Twin Cities, it's kind of a small prairie river in some ways, a little slow and not real deep. And then it passes through the gorge, and then eventually it makes a sharp turn into St. Paul and then turns south into the beautiful Valley of the Driftless area that probably most folks are familiar with.
Joel Patnaud, our producer for this show, wanted to point out the Kiona County State Recreation Area. It's a former iron ore mining site, now a popular place for mountain biking, as I understand it.
Yeah, I mean, part of the reason I wanted to include that in the book, it's centered around Crosby, Minnesota. So a couple of hours, maybe 2.5 hours away from the Twin Cities, depending upon where you're starting. It's an area where they had open pit mines that closed a long time ago, and nature sort of overtook or retook that place back. So you have some of the open pit mines are now deep lakes, and the hills that were the scraps from the mining era are now growing trees and other vegetation. So it's become a very popular place for mountain biking or just to kind of go to get away for a weekend. There's a lot of recreation opportunities there.
Yeah. Roger in Grantsburg, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Roger.
Hey, Larry, how are you doing today?
Great. Appreciate the call.
I was just wondering if your host or your guest, I live up in Grantsburg by the St. Croix. I'm only about 10 miles from the St. Croix River. And I wonder if you'd spend any time on that. That's a tributary of the Mississippi. It flows in at Prescott, Wisconsin. And I wonder if you've ever spent any time up there.
Yeah.
I have. I've spent some time on the lower St. Croix. Yeah, more around like Hudson and then down to Prescott in that area. And it's really beautiful there. It's got some similarities geologically, I think, to the Mississippi. Some of that part of the St. Croix was also essentially carved by glacial meltwaters a few thousand years ago. So you have the valley that looks pretty similar. But it's a beautiful spot, and I probably ought to spend more time in a canoe up there.
As I was going back to your book and looking at you, you have some really cool photos of the major tributaries of the Mississippi, which are really a cool shots.
Thanks. I got lucky a couple of years ago where I got to be a host to talk with a couple of politicians who were flying over the Mississippi from St. Louis down to Cairo, where the Ohio River meets the Mississippi. And I got to take a lot of pictures from there. So I got a really nice picture of the Ohio River from that plane.
Yeah, you did indeed. Roger, thanks again. Appreciate it. Jim in Newport Township, Illinois. Hi, Jim.
Yes, hello. According to knowledge I've been exposed to, at the confluence of the upper Mississippi with the Missouri, on average, about 70% of the flow is actually coming from the Missouri River. So, I mean, some people argue that it's not to take away that there are many wondrous things about the upper Mississippi, but it's like the Mississippi is flowing into the Missouri River rather than the way we accept it.
Then the other way around. Okay, well, what do you think, Dean?
It's funny. This is the second best way to start an argument among river rats is to ask which name should carry south from there. I have an entire presentation I put together just on this issue. So I'll give you the short version of it is really like historically, the Missouri and the upper Mississippi carried a fairly similar amount of water. It's a little hard to judge today because the flow of the upper Missouri of the Missouri River is managed by the dams on the upper part of the Missouri. So it's not a natural flow anymore. It is managed. But historically, you know, the Missouri would come up at a certain time of the year and then fall back. But if you average the volume over time, the two rivers were pretty similar. The Missouri is longer. So that's, you know, some people point to that. I like to think it's the Mississippi that's the river that's going north to south, and the Missouri is crashing into it. So, you know, it seems like the Mississippi ought to be, you know, for that reason and others, maybe that's the name that should be carrying forward.
Oh, boy. Jim, thanks a lot. And water. I mean, water, you write in the book that water across 1.25 million acres flows into the river.
It is a very big watershed. I think it's the third or fourth largest watershed in the world. And what's really crazy when you think about that is how concentrated all that water becomes further south. So by the time you get around like Vicksburg and Natchez and that part, all of that water, all these big rivers have fed into the Mississippi, and it's all in this one channel as it passes by Vicksburg, Baton Rouge, New Orleans. Now, there's some that's ciphered off above Baton Rouge, but that's an awful lot of water from a continent being funneled into one narrow channel.
It is indeed. Janie in Sugar Creek, Wisconsin, it's your turn. Hi, Janie.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. I heard you talking about overlooks on the Mississippi, and I thought of my home area, which is Burlington, Iowa, and there is a property on a bluff above, or actually below, if you're talking river, below a Burlington, and it's on Clay Street off of South Main, and it is the Leopold Dankwart property, and that's where our beloved Aldo Leopold grew up.
Ah, there you go.
That's right. Yeah, I didn't know that until I started doing some research, more research about Burlington a few years ago, Aldo Leopold's hometown. Almost certainly his childhood growing up near the Mississippi had some effect on his view of the natural world. And Burlington has its own big river history and some great places to see and experience the river. There's a pretty good culture of having cabins on islands in the Mississippi there, from what I understand. I got to visit one a few years ago and ride out there in a John boat and enjoy a couple of beers with somebody I just met as we watched the river flow. So kind of like a universal river activity.
Janie, thanks a lot for calling. I did not know that Burlington, Iowa is the childhood home of Aldo Leopold. So there you go. You can join in too, by the way. We're getting some great calls. What about experiences or things to share about the river? Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. I want to turn our attention a bit to Wisconsin, because in the book, I went and counted, you had 14 parks and wilderness and wildlife areas along the Mississippi on the Wisconsin side. That's got to be thousands of acres.
Yeah, and I had to leave some places out. So, yeah, Minnesota, Wisconsin especially, are blessed with a lot of public lands, and it made it difficult for me to figure out which ones to include and which ones to leave out. But part of it is, it is a lot of acres and it's growing. There are some organizations that are still buying private property along the river to preserve for future generations. So I wanted to make sure to include places that had a good mix of ecosystems and opportunities. So, you know, I ended up leaving out some really nice places just because I kind of duplicated something else. But I hope people will use this as a starting point. These, you know, the 14 places in Wisconsin, I think are really exceptional places and have a lot to offer. But there are a lot of other places I hope they'll also just take some time to explore, like the state natural areas. Like, I think everybody probably is familiar with the state parks and probably the wildlife refuges, but there are a lot of properties that are state natural areas that aren't as managed and don't have the number of visitors as the state parks and refuges tend to. They can be quieter places to visit.
Yeah, they can indeed. And, you know, this, just back in history just a bit there, in 1924, I believe, the Upper Mississippi River National Wildlife and Fish Refuge, you point out, was established. It was really interesting because there was a group of women who were important in getting this established.
Yeah, it took a coalition of people to really pull that off. And Will Dilg gets a lot of credit as the main person pushing and lobbying for this refuge, but he was one of the co-founders of the Isaac Walton League. But they could not have done it without the support of women's groups, without the support of other conservationists and some hunters. That what they did is they managed to get this refuge established essentially in one congressional session, which you think about how hard it is to get anything done today. And they did this in a few months, essentially. This something that had never, you know, they passed this legislation creating this refuge that had never been done on that scale before in this country. So we're still benefiting from that.
Yeah, I was thinking about the upper, the refuge in the, and they're different districts. So like the Winona district, for example, there's a dandy refuge right there.
Absolutely. I have a podcast about the Mississippi, and the last episode I released, I got to talk with the refuge manager and the visitor services coordinator from the Upper Miss Refuge. And there are so many fantastic places within the refuge itself. And I think part of the problem they struggle with is, you know, it's not like a state park and that there are real clear boundaries. Like, you know, when you're in the state park, because, well, in Minnesota, Wisconsin, you got to pay a fee to go in for one thing or have a sticker. But for the refuge, you can just wander in, and you may not realize that you're in territory that's part of this national refuge. So they're doing their part to make it easy, you know, make it more obvious which parts of the refuge. But there's some beautiful spots.
And along Wisconsin, what do we got? We got 230 miles of, you look at, as you say, bluffs, thick forest, and wetlands.
Yeah, so pick a spot. Like, you can't really lose, you know, with all that.
Oh, man. Bob in Cottage in Barnes, Wisconsin.
Hello, Larry.
Hi, Bob.
That was quick.
Well, how are things in Barnes?
Oh, it's beautiful, sunny, and about 68 degrees, and wonderful, and no bugs.
That's good to hear. We've got a cabin in Barnes area. So, well, what's your question or comment?
Well, my comment was that years ago we took houseboat rides up to from La Crosse to Winona, and had a wonderful time. And then Bemidji, Minnesota, was supposedly the start of the Mississippi River. Is that right?
Well, it's close. Bemidji's slogan is the first city on the Mississippi, but the river actually starts a bit downriver, like 60 miles at Itasca State Park.
But it's the first city.
Yes, and they make a big deal about that.
Oh, Bob, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Dean Klinkenberg, our guest today, we're talking about his new book out, Sandy. It's called The Wild Mississippi, A State-by-State Guide to the River's Natural Wonders. You can join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or shoot an email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking with Dean Klinkenberg, who has written The Wild Mississippi, A State-by-State Guide to the River's Natural Wonders. Great to have him with us. And again, you can join in. The number is 800-642-1234, or you can email to talk@WPR.org. Love to hear from you. Therese emailed to say they visited Wyalusing State Park many times, loves the view from campsites up on the cliff, and while paddling on the Mississippi River there, they've seen water snakes, a ton of fish. It's surprisingly calm and fascinating area. And Teresa added that the entire Driftless area has great rivers.
Oh, yeah, I'm not going to argue with that. So I love Wyalusing State Park as well. One of the things that's spectacular, and I'm not giving any secrets away with this. I think if you live in the area, you know this already, but there are a string of campground or campsites that are right on the edge of the bluff at Wyalusing State Park. And I've been lucky enough to camp there a handful of times. They go fast, especially on weekends. But it's really, the views are like million-dollar views, and you're just paying for a campsite. So I think that's, you know, it's a great opportunity for just about anybody to be able to enjoy those spectacular views. But the park has a paddle trail, you know, canoe trail that takes you through the backwaters, and it has hiking trails along the bluff and down to the floodplain forest. But this is kind of typical, as she was saying, for places along the Driftless area. There are lots of parks and nature areas and private places that you might be able to access that also have the same amenities. So we're very lucky to have access to it.
Yeah, absolutely. And you, in the book, you write that you really love the Trempealeau National Wildlife Refuge. Talk about it and why you love it.
If you like bird watching, and I'm not an expert birder, like I'm partially colorblind, so I'm never going to be a great birder. Yeah, I have an app that I use to help me identify what's around me by the sounds or the songs the birds are making. But at Trempealeau Refuge, you don't really need much of an app. There's a big area of wetlands with an easy view of the visitor center that attracts a lot of waterfowl, especially in the spring and fall. And I've seen beavers in some of the backwater habitats. There's a dike you can hike out along about half a mile or three quarters of a mile that passes through these wetland habitats where there's often a lot of mammals and other wildlife going on. I just find it a very peaceful place. One of the unfortunate things about some of the parks along the Mississippi is that sometimes there are train tracks that run right next to them or through them. So sometimes the noise can get to be a lot. But at Trempealeau Refuge, the train tracks are far away. It's not next to the highway. So I think there's a quietness and a serenity to that place that a lot of other places don't have. And just so much, you know, so many birds to watch.
Jeff and Barry Mills, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Jeff.
Yes, I just wanted to bring up a book I read quite a few years back. I don't recall who the author was. I think the book was The History of the Mississippi River from the Beginning of Time. It talks about how most of North America was just a lake or something at the time, and I found it to be just fascinating.
Yeah, I don't know. I can't think of the author on that one. Dean, do you?
I'm not familiar with that book. No, I may have to look that up and see if I can find it. I did a fair amount of research on the geology of the Mississippi River and North America when I was writing that first chapter. So what I have in there is a really thumbnail sketch of that history. But it is really fascinating to get into the details of how the Mississippi developed and how it changed over time.
Jeff, thank you for calling. Prairie in Clyde, Wisconsin, your turn. Hi, thank you for calling.
Oh, hey, yeah, I was so excited to turn on the radio and hear you talking about the Mississippi. We, about 12 years ago, my partner and I did a bike trip, went down a good bit of it, at least between here and central Missouri. And we've kind of always had a daydream of loading the family up.
Oh, we lost him. We lost him. I bet he was thinking about loading the family up and taking them the whole length.
Yeah.
Oh, are you back, Bray?
Yeah. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. I'm sorry. We've had this daydream of the doing like a houseboat or a longer term, you know, camping and river, you know, exploring it from the river. And I wonder if, you know, is that realistic? Do people still do that? Yeah. What do you think about that idea?
Yeah.
Yeah. People do it. You know, there's a small community of people who do the Great Circle, you know, the route that basically goes through the Great Lakes down the Mississippi and the Intercoastal Waterway and then back up the East Coast and down the St. Lawrence River. They're certainly doing that. There are some people who do some longer term boat trips on the Mississippi. I think at this point, it's mostly paddlers who are doing those kinds of trips. That I hear about, but there may be others in houseboats or other kinds of boats. But it's also just an easy place to drive along. There are a lot of campgrounds along the river, some of them right next to the river, some of them big enough to accommodate big RVs and others that might only be, you know, ideal for a tent. So there are lots of different ways to explore it.
Yeah, that Great River Road is I think probably if you're driving that's probably think about the Mississippi River, that's probably the best drive you're going to get on the Mississippi, at least in my mind. I don't know about you.
Oh, absolutely. It runs, I probably should have this memorized. I have another book that's just for the Great River Road, but it's something like 25 or 2700 miles on each side of the river. So you can drive down one side and turn around and come back up the other side, depending upon how much time you want to kill. I really hope, though, when people do this drive, that my goal is to help people slow down with these trips.
Yeah.
I think the beauty in the river comes from spending time and really watching and observing things and slowing down. I hope more people do that rather than trying to squeeze in 1,000 miles in 4 days or something.
Yeah. There's so many towns, places along, which you recount in your book.
Yeah. There are just all kinds of little beautiful river towns along the way. And there's always, you know, it seems like there's always a bar right next to the river that's got good burgers and fries and good views, so, and good stories. Usually some river rats hanging out in there that'll talk your ears off.
Yeah, Kenny Solway almost talked my ear off more than one time. who wrote, and I think you mentioned him in the book, in your book, The Last River Rat. It was a great book.
Oh, I love that book. And it really had a big influence on me, too, because he just does such a great job of detailing how the life along the river changes across the seasons. I think it was a beautiful book.
Yeah. Tim and Madison, your turn. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Larry. Yeah, talking about narratives about the Mississippi River, as a history teacher and history buff, you know, reading some of those early narratives, you know, like from Father Marquette or Zebulon Pike or Henry Schoolcraft, you know, it's just gives a great opportunity to learn more about what the river was like, you know, decades and centuries ago. So I would recommend that to any history buffs that want to learn more about, you know, the history river, the Mississippi River that way.
Yeah, Tim, thank you so much for calling. Dean, you'd agree with that, I bet.
I would. There's a guy named Thomas, I'm going to butcher his name, Thomas Rice Smith, who has a book that he wrote kind of summarizing those early travel narratives along the Mississippi. I think those books are really interesting, and they continue to this day. People are still writing books about their experiences traveling along the Mississippi. So I think it's a great genre, and every one of those kind of gives you a slightly different perspective on the river and the river at different points in time.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite spot on the river?
Yeah, boy. I'm still partial to La Crosse in a lot of ways. I know I'm not supposed to pick favorites as somebody who writes about the entire river and is trying to talk about the whole river. I lived in La Crosse for 6 years when I was in college, and I stuck around for a year after that. And I'm still so attached to that part of the river. I like the scenic beauty, the bluffs, and the ease of getting on the water there, and the fact that there's still those lush backwaters intact in a lot of places. I think it's just... any place in that area, and especially in the Driftless area, is high on my list.
Yeah, I would agree. I've been up there in the fall to do a little bird watching on the fall migration up through that area is fantastic.
Absolutely, and I will say too, downplay this, but I really love the lower Mississippi as well, and I think more people should find ways to experience that and see the beauty in that as well. It's just that it's a little harder to access for most of us, because for some of it, you really kind of need a boat, whether it's a canoe or something with a motor, but you really need a boat and a chance to get out on the water and stay there for a little while to fully appreciate that, I think.
Yeah, I think you're probably right about that. We didn't mention much about Missouri, but what's your favorite spot in Missouri?
I love, one of the easiest places for me to get to is up at the confluence of the Missouri and Mississippi. There's a place called Columbia Bottom State Conservation Area, and I love hiking there. I've been up there a lot the last few years. So that's great, because sometimes the river gets low and the back channel dries out, and I can walk to an island, which is a fun experience. But second favorite, I love Trail of Tears State Park, where, yeah, for the reminder of the history, but also for the natural beauty in that particular area.
Yeah, that's got to be a really thoughtful place to visit and reflect.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, how's the book doing? Just out.
Well, I hope. It's been out a little over a week or a week. Yeah, I'm losing track of time. It was released on the 21st. So I've been very happy with the feedback I've gotten so far. I'm thrilled to have this book out. Like, I joke with folks, like, anytime a book comes out, I feel this mix of excitement and terror. I'm never entirely sure what the reception's going to be. And I put a lot into this book. I really wanted this to be something that people would turn to and would help them see the river in a new way. So hopefully it's doing that.
I think it is, Dean, and I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. It's been a real pleasure talking with you and learning more about the Wild Mississippi. That's the title of Dean's book, by the way, The Wild Mississippi, A State-by-State Guide to the River's Natural Wonders. Been a pleasure talking with him, and a whole lot more coming up, so you stay with us. I'm Larry Mealy.